In the days of anxiety and turmoil following the massacre of Sharpeville, Favut and his Minister of Police acted with resolution and strength. A state of emergency was declared in almost half of South Africa's magisterial districts. Both the PAC and ANC were banned, and those of their supporters suspected of incitement and intimidation were arrested and detained under the emergency regulations. Some estimates put the figure of detainees as high as 18,000. In early April, at the meeting of the full cabinet to discuss the emergency, Shaza Courtney risked his political future by rising to address a plea to Dr. Favut for the abolition of the passbook system. He had prepared his speech with care, and the genuine concern he felt for the importance of the subject made him even more than usually eloquent. As he spoke, he became gradually aware that he was winning the support of some of the other senior members of the cabinet. "In a single stroke, we will be removing the main cause of black dissatisfaction and depriving the revolutionary agitators of their most valuable weapon," he pointed out. Three other senior ministers followed Shaza, each voicing their support for the abolition of the Dompas. But from the top of the long table, Favut glowered at them, becoming every minute more angry, until at last he jumped to his feet. "The idea is completely out of the question. The reference books are there for an essential purpose, to control the influx of blacks into the urban areas." Within a few minutes he had brutally bludgeoned the proposal to death, and made it clear that to try to resurrect it would be political suicide for any member of the cabinet, no matter how senior. Within days, Dr. Hendrik Favut was himself on the brink of the chasm. He visited Johannesburg to open the Rand Easter Show. He made a reassuring speech to the huge audience that filled the arena of the country's largest agricultural and industrial show, and as he sat down to thunderous applause, a white man of insignificant appearance made his way between the tiers of seats and, in full view of everybody, drew a pistol and, holding it to Dr. Favut's head, fired two shots. With blood pouring down his face, Favut collapsed, and security guards overpowered his assailant. Both bullets, fired at point-blank range, had penetrated the Prime Minister's skull, and yet his most remarkable tenacity and will to survive, combined with the expert medical attention he received, saved him. In little more than a month he had left hospital and had once more taken up his duties as the head of the state. The assassination attempt seemed to have been without motive or reason, and the assailant was judged insane and placed in an asylum. By the time Dr. Favut had fully recovered from the attempt on his life, calm had been restored to the country as a whole, and Manfred de la Rey's police were in total control once more. Naturally, the reaction of the international community towards the slaughter and the subsequent measures to regain control was heavily critical. America led the rest in her condemnations, and within months had instituted an embargo on the sale of arms to South Africa. More damaging than the reaction of foreign governments was the crash on the Johannesburg Stock Exchange, the collapse of property values, and the attempted flight of capital out of the country. Strict exchange control regulations were swiftly imposed to forestall this. Manfred de la Rey had come out of it all with his power and position greatly enhanced. He had acted the way his people expected him to, with strength and forthright determination. There was no doubt at all now that he was one of the senior members of the cabinet, and in the direct line of succession to Hendrik Favut. He had smashed the Pan-Africanist Congress and the ANC. Their leaders were in total disarray, and all of them were in hiding or had fled the country. With the safety of the state secured, Dr. Favut could at last turn his full attention to the momentous business of realizing the golden dream of Afrikanerdom, the Republic. The referendum was held in October 1960, and so great were the feelings for and against, engendered by the prospect of breaking with the British Crown, that there was a 90% poll. Cunningly, Favut had decreed that a simple majority, and not the usual two-thirds majority, would suffice. And on the day, he got his majority, 850,000 to 775,000. The Afrikaner response was an hysteria of joy, of speeches and wild rejoicing. In March the following year, Favut and his entourage went to London to attend the conference of the Commonwealth Prime Ministers. He came out of the meeting to tell the world, in the light of opinions expressed by other member governments of the Commonwealth regarding South Africa's race policies, and in the light of future plans regarding the race policies of the South African government, I told the other Prime Ministers that I was withdrawing my country's application for continued membership of the Commonwealth after attaining the status of a republic. From Pretoria, Manfred de la Rey cabled for Voet, "You have preserved the dignity and pride of your country, and the nation owes you eternal gratitude." Voet returned home to the adulation and hero worship of his people. In the heady euphoria, very few, even amongst the English-speaking opposition, realized just how many doors Voet had locked and barred behind him, and just how cold and bleak the winds that Macmillan had predicted would blow across the southern tip of Africa in the coming years. With the Republic safely launched, Voet could at last select his Praetorian Guard to protect it and hold it strong. Erasmus, the erstwhile Minister of Justice, who had acted neither as ruthlessly nor as resolutely as was expected during the emergency, was packed off as the ambassador of the new Republic to Rome, and Voet presented two new ministers to his cabinet. The new Minister of Defence was the member for the constituency of George in the Cape, P.W. Botha, while Erasmus's replacement as Minister of Justice was Balthazar Johannes Forster. Shaza Courtney knew Forster well, and as he listened to him make his first address to the cabinet, he reflected how much like Manfred de la Rey the man was. They were almost the same age, and like Manfred, Forster had been a member of the extreme right-wing anti-Smuts pro-Nazi Ossovar Brandwach during the war. Whereas it was generally accepted that Manfred had remained in Germany during the war years, although he was very mysterious and secretive about that period of his life, John Forster had been interned in Smuts's Koffiefontein concentration camp for the duration. Both Forster and de la Rey had been educated at Stellenbosch University, the citadel of Afrikanerdom, and their political careers had run closely parallel courses. Although Manfred had won his seat in Parliament in the historic 1948 elections, John Forster, in the same elections, had gained the distinction of being the only candidate in South African history to lose by a mere 2 votes. Later, in 1953, he vindicated himself by winning the same Brakpan seat with a majority of 700. Now that the two of them were seated at the long table in the cabinet room, their physical resemblance was striking. They were both heavy, rugged-looking men, with bulldog features, both obdurate, unflinching and tough, the epitome of the hard Boer. Forster confirmed this for Shaza as he began to speak, leaning forward aggressively, confident and articulate. "I believe we are in a fight to the death with the forces of communism, and that we cannot defeat subversion or thwart revolution by closely observing the Queensberry rules. We have to put aside the old precepts of habeas corpus and arm ourselves with new legislation that will enable us to preempt the enemy, to pick out their leaders and put them away where they can do little harm." "This is not a new concept, gentlemen." Forster smiled down the table, and Shaza was struck by the way in which his dour features lit up with that impish smile. "You all know where I spent the war years, without the benefit of trial. Let me tell you right now, it worked. It kept me out of mischief, and that's what I intend to do with those who would destroy this land. Keep them out of mischief. I want power to detain any person whom I know to be an enemy of the state, without trial, for a period of up to 90 days. It was a masterly performance, and Shaza felt some trepidation in having to follow it, especially when he could not be so sanguine in his own view of the future. "At the moment I have 2 major concerns, he told his colleagues seriously. "The first is the arms embargo placed upon us by the Americans. I believe that other countries are soon going to bow to American pressure and extend the embargo. One day we might even have the ridiculous situation where Great Britain will refuse to sell us the arms we need for our own defence." Some of the others at the table fidgeted and looked incredulous. Shaza assured them, "We cannot afford to underestimate the hysteria of America for what they call civil rights. Remember that they sent troops to help force blacks into white schools. The memory of that appalled them all, and there were no further signs of disbelief as Shaza went on. A nation who can do that will do anything. My aim is to make this country totally self-sufficient in conventional armaments within 5 years. Is that possible? Favut asked sharply. I believe so, Shaza nodded. Fortunately, this eventuality has been anticipated. You yourself warned me of the possibility of an arms embargo when you appointed me Prime Minister. Favut nodded, and Shaza repeated. This is my aim. Self-sufficient in conventional weapons in 5 years. Shaza paused dramatically. And nuclear-capable in 10 years. This was stretching their credulity, and there were interjections and sharp questions, so that Shaza held up his hands and spoke firmly. I am deadly serious, gentlemen. We can do it, given certain circumstances. Money, said Hendrik Favut, and Shaza nodded. Yes, Prime Minister, money. Which brings me to my second major consideration. Shaza drew a deep breath and steeled himself to broach an unpalatable truth. Since the Sharpeville shootings, we have had a crippling flight of capital from the country. Cecil Rhodes was wont to say that the Jews were his birds of good omen. When the Jews came, an enterprise or a country was assured of success, and when the Jews left, you could expect the worst. Well, the sad truth, gentlemen, is that our Jews are leaving. We have to entice them to stay and bring back those who have already left. Again there was restlessness around the table. The National Party had been conceived on that wave of anti-Semitism between the world wars, and although it had abated since then, traces of it still existed. These are the facts, gentlemen. Shaza ignored their discomfort. Since Sharpeville, the value of property has collapsed to half what it was before the shooting, and the stock market is at its lowest level since the dark days of Dunkirk. The businessmen and investors of the world are convinced that this government is tottering and on the point of capitulating to the forces of communism and darkness. They see us as being engulfed in despondency and anarchy, with black mobs burning and looting, and white civilization about to go up in flames. They laughed derisively as John Forster made a bitter interjection. I have just explained what steps we will take. Yes, Shaza cut him off quickly. We know that the foreign view is distorted. We know that we will still have a strong and stable government, that the country is prosperous and productive, and that the vast majority of our people, both black and white, are law-abiding and content. We know that we have our guardian angel, gold, to protect us. But we have to convince the rest of the world. Do you think that's possible, man? Manfred asked quickly. Yes, with a full-scale and concerted campaign to give the truth of the situation to the businessmen of the world, Shaza said. I have recruited most of our own leaders in industry and commerce to assist. We will go out at our own expense to explain the truth. We will invite them here, journalists, businessmen and friends, to see for themselves how tranquil and how under control the country truly is. And just how rich are the opportunities. Shaza spoke for another 30 minutes, and when he ended, his own fervour and sincerity had exhausted him. But then he saw how he had finally convinced his colleagues, and he knew the results were worth the effort. He was convinced that from the horror of Sharpeville he could mount a fresh endeavour that would carry them to greater heights of prosperity and strength. Shaza had always been resilient, with extraordinary recuperative powers, even in his Air Force days, when he brought the squadron in from a sortie over the Italian lines, and the others had sat around the mess, stunned and shattered by the experience. He had been the first to recover and to start the repartee and boisterous horseplay. Shaza left the cabinet room drained and exhausted. But by the time he had driven the vintage SS Jaguar around the mountain and through the unwreathed gate of Veltefrieden, he was sitting up straight in the bucket seat, feeling confident and jaunty again. The harvest was long past, and the labourers were in the vineyards pruning the vines. Shaza parked the Jaguar and went down between the rows of bare, leafless plants to talk to them and give them encouragement. Many of these men and women had been on Veltefrieden since Shaza had been a child, and the younger ones had been born here. Shaza looked upon them as an extension of his family, and they in turn regarded him as their patriarch. He spent half an hour with them, listening to their small problems and worries, and settling most with a few words of assurance. Then he broke off and left them abruptly, as a figure on horseback came down the far side of the vineyard at full gallop. From the corner of the stone wall, Shaza watched Isabella gather her mount, and he stiffened as he realized what she was going to do. The mare was not yet fully schooled, and Shaza had never trusted her temperament. The wall was of yellow Table Mountain sandstone, 5 foot high. "No, Bella," he whispered. "No, baby." But she turned the mare and drove her at the wall, and the horse reacted gamely. Her quarters bunched, and the great muscles rippled below the glossy hide. Isabella lifted her, and they went up. Shaza held his breath, but even in his suspense he could appreciate what a magnificent sight they made, horse and rider, thoroughbreds both. The mare with her forelegs folded up under her chest, and her ears pricked forward, soaring away from the earth, and Isabella leaning back in the saddle, her back arched, and her young body supple and lovely, long legs and fine thrusting breasts, red mouth laughing, and her hair flying free, sparkling with ruby lights in the late yellow sunlight. Then they were over, and Shaza exhaled sharply. Isabella swung the mare down to where he stood at the corner. "You promised to ride with me, Pater," she scolded him. Shaza's instinct was to reprimand her for that jump, but he prevented himself. He knew she would probably respond by pulling the mare's head around and taking the jump again from this side. He wondered just when he had lost control of her, and then grinned ruefully as he answered himself. "About 10 minutes after she was born."